It's not the time to diversify your economy. It's not the time to try to open up more fields to food crops for your own people. It's the time to increase export crops. So you put even more land in the production of those. You slack off on environmental concerns so that you can increase your production. Those kinds of things are some of the effects. And you decrease spending. You cut jobs in the government. The wages go down, so you don't have to pay as much out to people. And you cut things like social programs, health programs, education, and food subsidies. And the IMF will actually come into a country, study the situation, and say, this is what you need to do. Cut this program, cut these amount of jobs, so on and so forth. Another thing that's sometimes done is devaluation of currency. If we have time, I'll come back to that and explain it. But it takes a little bit of time to explain why devaluing your currency. But basically, what devaluing your currency does is lower the value of your currency in relation to the dollar, which then has an incentive for cutting imports, because you have to pay more in your own currency to buy things, and increasing the amount of foreign investment, because somebody can bring dollars and get more in your local currency and then invest that in the country. So those are the kinds of things. But what happens if the currency is devalued for the local people? It means that anything imported goes up in price. And most of the third world countries depend greatly on imports because they don't grow all their own food. They don't manufacture basic need products. They have to import all that stuff. So now they're having to pay more at the same time that their programs, social programs are being cut. Wages are declining. So we reach a situation where the debt crisis no longer is just some large, magnanimous financial problem that banks and governments deal with. It is a problem that directly affects daily lives of people in these countries. Yes?
What kind of clout does the IMF have? I mean, what can they do? I mean, they need to do this and this and this. And it's hard for me to imagine the countries say, okay, that's what we'll do. I mean, what's
okay.
The threat?
All right, a lot of the threat has to do, there's a lot of things. The IMF is primarily controlled by the United States and the sort of developed countries. These countries are dependent on those countries to sell their products. They're dependent on them for aid. They're dependent on them for new loans, even to do other kinds of things. If the IMF, an example is that a few years ago, Peru decided, we can't pay this off. Now, we're still going to take responsibility for paying our loan, but we're going to say we will pay 10% of our export earnings every year. That's what we can afford to pay on our debt. And we'll pay that faithfully, but we're not going to pay any more than that. Well, that was great for a year. And their economy boomed because for the first time in years they'd actually been able to invest back into their own economy. But the international banking community and financial community basically cut them off. And so there was all this pressure from other countries, don't buy these products, don't give them any short-term loans for businesses to invest in different things. So they are so dependent financially in a lot of different ways on the first world, and the IMF wields that kind of power. But it's not the IMF itself, it's the member nations. But yeah, it's a very good question though. Thanks, excellent question. Something else? No? Okay. So basically we have this situation where, and let me just read, I could read example after example after example, which we won't do, but I read some at the beginning of Bolivia. That's the effect that the debt crisis has on local people. Well, where is it? Oh, here it is. This is just one example of sort of how it works itself out in the Philippines. A peasant woman on Mindoro Island, the Philippines, held in her fist a bundle of gnarled mud cake roots. This is what we have to eat, she said. This is all we have to eat, even on holidays. Look what we have been reduced to. Joel Charney, Oxfam America's Regional Director for Asia and Latin America, has traveled extensively in the Philippines. He reports that farmers there have lower rice yields and less to eat as a direct result of the country's debt crisis. Okay, how does that spell itself out? Most families on Mindoro have access to 1 or 2 hectares of land, which is about 2.5 to 5 acres of rice land. According to Charney, the rice they plant, if grown with enough fertilizer, ought to yield at least 3 or 4 tons of unmilled rice per hectare. But Mindoro farmers have been able to harvest only about 1.5 tons of rice for each hectare because they cannot afford fertilizer. Now, we may have trouble with the amount of fertilizer that's used in the third world. That's a whole other issue. But these people depend on that right now for their survival because there's no other options. So after paying land, rent, and money borrowed for last year's planting, they are left with only enough rice to feed a family of 6 for 4 months. Fertilizer prices have gone up because of they're imported. Fertilizers are imports in a lot of these countries. It's in El Salvador, fertilizer is all imported, unless you use organic stuff, which is hard to do. I can read a whole list of other things here. In the Dominican Republic, half the population is undernourished, and many people have resorted to eating rats to survive because of some of the cuts in food subsidies, primarily, as much as anything else. Infant mortality has gone from 64 per thousand to 80 per thousand. About 70% of the population of the Philippines now live below the poverty line, compared to 45% in the early 70s. Poverty is worse in the world now than it was 15, 20 years ago. We've got to understand that. Infant mortality rates are worse. Health conditions are worse. We're not developing, we're getting worse.
Is that just in third world countries, or is that in, because it seems to be like in America and Australia and all the other developed countries, that it's not so bad and things seem to be getting better with increasing health rates and stuff like that?
I think there's some parts of our economy that are very shaky, but I think for the most part, yeah, we're in good shape. And I think that there we'll get to a second in a minute, but the gap between the North and the South is growing instead of there being any kind of equalization going on.
It's sort of interesting to think that during the 80s, in the Reagan era, that the money for social programs and public housing and all that sort of stuff went down in this country. I mean, certainly homeless people are much more numerous today than they were 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's true. But in terms of the overall economy,
it sounds like
getting into a whole domestic economics thing, and there are differences there. But basically, people in the first world, I mean, we're doing okay. There hasn't been the drastic kinds of changes that you've found. I mean, there's a depression in the third world right now that's worse than the 1930s worldwide, and most people don't know that.
So the United States national debt hasn't affected our own standard of living.
Well, I think it affects third world standard of living because that kind of debt keeps interest rates up.
Uh-huh.
But it also, and again, I'm not an economist and I don't want to pretend to try to sort of say that I can tell you exactly how the national debt's going to affect our own economy, but it does. And part of that has to do, I tell you what, if we have time, I'll get to some of that stuff in it, which is more of the third world debt itself. Okay, I could read example after example in Zambia and in other places in Latin America of just how food subsidies are cut, people's level of hunger, the level of malnourishment has gone up primarily because of the debt crisis and the amount of money that's having to be sent back out of the country. Some response to that, as some countries have just not been able to pay it. Peru, I gave the example of that. Brazil cut off their payments a few years ago and now have renegotiated. Actually, one thing that I should mention too is that since one of the IMF's other parts of their program, which I should have put up here, was additional loans. So that since 1982, the problem has not gotten any better. It's really gotten worse. In 1983, 79% of all new loans taken out by developing countries were used just to pay the interest on the old loans. They didn't still could make a dent in the principal, but just to continue the process so that banks sort of still had the flow going and could prove to their shareholders that these were still good loans, the IMF and the banks together sort of pushed those kinds of policies. So that since 19, we saw in the chart, or I think in 1981, I don't know, it's sort of down there in the pile now, the amount of total loans out was something like, what was it, 700 billion, I think, and now it's over a trillion. So it continues to go up, is what I'm trying to say. In the last few years, it's starting to come down a little bit because of some measure of people recognizing that this is not going to go away. There's not a short-term cash flow problem, that this is a serious problem, and nobody's going to be able to pay off all these loans, and so there has been some kind of effort to try to solve that. So let's just real quickly look at some of those and some of the proposals. Now, I've divided the proposed solutions into two categories, those that come from the north and those that come from the south. They're a little different. They're the two main proposals that are often considered now are the Baker and the Brady plan. James Baker was the Secretary of the Treasury back in the mid-80s, and he proposed what was called the Baker plan. It was never really accepted because the main thing that he really pushed was even more loans. And the banks by that time said, we're not making any more. Okay, in 1989, Brady proposed his plan. And basically that there are a lot of characteristics that are pretty much the same. Basically, it's the continued supervision of the IMF. Is the main sort of difference, or the main change in all this, is to transfer the risk from private banks to governments and public international organizations through additional loans. Don't recognize responsibility banks. What that means is the idea is that governments and the IMF and other international organizations would buy up the loans from the bank. Now, you probably say, what does that mean for somebody to buy a loan? It means that if Citicorp Bank has a loan to Brazil for $2 billion, the government might come in and say, okay, everyone accepts the fact that you're never going to get all your money back. The market rate for that loan is 40% of that. So we'll pay you, what would that be, $800 million, and then we'll have the loan. All right, the government of Brazil will have to pay us back. You won't be responsible anymore. You've gotten $800 million and you will consider your loan canceled.
Who's the we in it?
The government of, the IMF, say, or other international organizations. I probably lost people there.
Yeah.
All right, let's say that, before I get into this, say the idea is that it's really a great deal for the banks.
Yes.
They're not getting the full principal back, but I want to say some more about that. They've already made a load of money off of this stuff, and that's really important to know. They've made huge profits. They're not losing. So the idea is they're still going to get, even though they've made bad loans and they've mismanaged it all, they're still going to get $800 million out of a $2 billion loan on the principal, even though they've already made more than that. I mean, Latin Americans say the loans have been paid over and over in some ways in terms of the amount of profits that banks have made. Before I go on, let me just tell you what some statistics here. The In 1970, Third World loans to U.S. primary, the seven largest U.S. banks, were 22% of their profit. In 1982, 60% of their profit came from Third World loans. In 1982, 20% of all of Citicorp's profits came just from their loans to Brazil. Okay, 1982 to 1984, the six major banks made, after tax, they made profits of $652 million just in, I'm sorry, that was just in 2 years, I guess. In 1982 to 1985, their profits went up 33%, primarily because of these loans. And the banks have made a fortune. I mean, fortune maybe is not the right word for a bank, but anyway, they made a lot of money on it. They have not lost in the long run. Okay, getting back to the example. So the idea here is we're even going to protect the banks more now. All right, if we have $2 billion that's still owed by Brazil, and this is, say, a Citicorp loan. Okay, the idea is that the IMF, or some other, let's say the IMF in this case, is going to say, okay, let's negotiate a price with you, all right? We're not going to pay you $2 billion, because that loan's not worth $2 billion anymore. Everybody knows it's never going to get paid. So basically, we'll pay you 40% of that loan. We'll pay you $800 million. And then for you, the bank, for Citicorp, the loan's canceled. They no longer have to worry about it. Now, Brazil owes IMF $800 million. Now, there are various things they can do with that, which we'll get to in a minute. I mean, they can just keep it as a regular loan or whatever.
So they're going to reduce it. In other words, the Brazil won't still owe $2 billion. They won't hold the whole principal to them.
No, in most of the cases it would be reduced, but they could still have a leverage of $2 billion. One of the things that happens is they can use that for various programs. They can say you still owe us $800 million and it's still as a formal loan, or they can say there are a lot of proposals. Like they can say, we will allow you to put that amount of money into certain kinds of programs. Environmental programs is a big one right now, of saying, Brazil, you're destroying the Amazon, so the IMF isn't going to do this, but other organizations. For instance, there are a couple big environmental organizations that have bought up loans. They did that in Bolivia, and which they bought it from the bank for, I think, about 30% of the cost of the loan, and then they went to the government of Bolivia and they said, we'll cancel this loan if you do this, 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 and this. And you basically, the biggest part was that you put aside a huge tract of land as a preserve.
So basically, they wouldn't be paying, I mean, if there was no deal made, and the IMF had this note for $2 billion, they would be charging interest on $800 million?
I think so.
Have to be paying the interest.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, it could be either way, depending on what you negotiate. It's really sort of a negotiated kind of thing. Yes.
That sounds really good, but it doesn't work. I mean, when you're talking about, a country, an organization buying up a debt, but then going to the government and saying, we'll cancel your debt if you do this.
That kind of stuff can be good. There are several problems with it. Number one is it really fair still to have even environmental organizations having that kind of power over third world countries? I mean, that's a question. Maybe it is. I'm not saying one way or another. But we're still saying that first world people are demanding what third world people do. The second thing is that it's a very small amount of money that can really be channeled this way. I mean, we're talking about huge numbers. You're talking about $1 trillion in debt. Well, the IMF and other people don't have that kind of money to to buy up even at 40% and just solve the whole problem like that. So we're talking about a portion of it being done. One of the other things that's really important is that they, part of these plans are very clear that they will only negotiate on a case-by-case basis. In other words, they will negotiate with Brazil their loans. And some of the questions you're asking would depend on what they negotiate. All right? And they will negotiate with Argentina, and they will negotiate with Panama, but they will not negotiate with South American countries altogether. See, they don't want to give up that kind of power. They still will not give any fixed interest rates. They still say it has to be floating. And it only deals, as I was saying, it only deals with a part of the debt, really. And there's only a small group of people, of debtors, I should say, or countries that are involved. Debt equity swaps, again, we're probably not going to have time, but that's, debt equity swaps are what I was just talking about in terms of buying up a certain portion of the debt, another, and then saying, put it into environmental concerns. We'll swap you the debt for your agreement to do this. Another way to do it is, say a large multinational corporation could buy this debt for $800 million and then go into Brazil and say, okay, and this would all be negotiated ahead of time, say, give us $800 million in Brazilian currency and we'll invest it in Brazil, but we don't need dollars. So if Brazil can do that, I mean, still not, it's not that they automatically have that kind of money, even Brazilian currency sitting around, but the problem with that is that multinational corporations already control so much, and now they're going to control more. They're going to buy up factories, they're going to buy up land in Brazil. But for the sake of time, let me just run on then. From more of the third world countries, the proposals, they vary depending on who you talk to. And you know, a lot of people just say, look, banks have already made money off of this. We ought to just cancel all this stuff and you governments can work out some way of doing it so the banks aren't going to collapse. And but most people are a little more realistic than that. And these are some of the proposals that come from the South, from governments as well as other organizations. First of all, having some grace periods, of having some years, a few years where they don't have to pay anything, just to give them breathing space. That in itself would not solve a whole lot of problems. Costa Rica has had 4 years of grace period, now they're coming up on the end of it, and they're still in the same boat. They have a huge debt. Extension of the payment periods, you mentioned that as one of the things that you might do, is extend it out so that you have longer to pay this stuff. Reduction of the principal, in other words, forgive at least part of it. Say, you know, look, you've already made a huge profit. Instead of us owing you, you know, $50 billion, we're going to owe you $25 billion. And separating, in terms of reduction of real interest rates, reducing the interest rates to some degree, fixed, trying to get fixed interest rates would be part of that, and making a distinction between the old loans and the new loans. Basically saying, we will commit ourselves to paying the new loans that we've taken out in the last few years. But the old loans, you've already made your money off of those, and you've already really gotten your principal back in them. So give us really easy terms on those. We'll pay some of it off still, but let's make a distinction between the two. Increase in commercial bank lending. I mean, they still need money flowing into these countries to develop. And right now, the banks are not giving that money to them very much because of the debt. Right. And then linkage. The idea of what I was talking about with Peru, saying negotiate an arrangement where countries only have to pay what they can pay. I mean, it's impossible to pay what most countries are being asked to pay. They can't do it without people starving to death, is what it amounts to. So like Peru saying, okay, Peru can afford to spend 10% every year of its total import-export earnings on servicing the debt. So that's what we'll do. We'll negotiate that. Some other country may be able to only pay 8%, and somebody else may be able to pay 20%. But we'll base that on. Okay, and then the final thing, there is a South American group called the Cartagena Group. Cartagena is a city in Colombia where they met. that have tried and were very close at one time of taking a card, making a cartel sort of decision, saying we'll be a debtors cartel. Fidel Castro has been pushing this for a long time, saying, why doesn't everybody get together and say, this is what we'll do, and if you don't buy this, we're not going to pay anything. And if you could really get everyone together to do that, it would really be powerful. And the Western banks and governments would have to listen to it. What are we doing here?
Yeah.
Boy. All right. Okay, let me just very briefly mention Flick here, and then I can do this in just a couple minutes, and I think we can, anyone else who wants to stay around, the line's probably still another 10 minutes long. The idea of this is just to say that, you know, in my opinion, I'm going to talk a little bit more tomorrow about, I think the title is what your tax dollars pay for in El Salvador, but it's another example, I think, of the way the first world really has this sort of tight clinch around people in the third world, and we really benefit from that economically. There's no doubt about that. When we look at our own debt in terms of in the United States, and that, I think that's a crucial thing to consider, but if you really look at the differences, the debt in Central America is 100% of its gross national product, I mean the principal. Whereas the debt in the first world is only 8% of its total gross national product. And I'm not sure what it is for the United States, but it's certainly less than 100%. So we have to make those distinctions in terms of what's happening in terms of the relationship between our debt and the third world debt. And then the most important thing is to say that since 1982, there is actually a net flow of resources from the third world to the first world. In other words, it's like poor people are paying the wealthy in the world. So if you take, this is just a chart. In 1980, if you took all the things that flowed from the north to the south, when I say north, I'm saying first world, I'm talking about north, United States, Canada, Western Europe, Japan. If you add up, and this includes development aid, so it's foreign aid that we pour into places, export credits, private financial flows like investments, bank loans includes, grants from non-governmental agencies. If we took everything that goes from the north to the south, it was $128 billion. Everything that went from the south to the north, which would be debt service flows and other things that would flow, it mostly would be debt. I mean, it's not like... Okay, it's $84 billion. So there was a net gain for the south still of $44 billion. All right? Now, if you look down, it changes. The net flow in 36. In 1982 is the first year where the net flow from the south to the north is larger than what is going from the north to the south. And it gets larger and larger until 1985 to 68, now it's about 1987. I don't have figures since then. But $62 billion in net flow is actually coming from the poor to the wealthy, because related to a lot of things, but primarily because of the debt crisis. So you have a total from 1980 to 1987, a net flow of $206 billion that goes from the poor to the rich. You know, that's basically what Julius Nyerere, who's the former president of Tanzania, says is basically a new form of empire building. And that we have to take that seriously. I'm looking for another quote here, which I seem to have lost. The United States have been directly affected by that in terms of their markets, have been, as export crops in the third world are increased, the market in the global market for certain crops gets glutted and prices go down. So our farmers in the United States have been affected in that way. There's also ways, I won't go in and explain it all now, but it's estimated that probably about 1 million jobs have been lost in the United States due to the debt crisis because of loss of markets. Not in farming, but in other manufacturing kind of things. So, and there's some other ways there too. I mean, the bailout of savings and loans. Not savings and loans. What was the name of the bank? Continental Illinois Bank. They had a lot of problems, but part of their problems was they had loans that were never paid. And then finally, let me just, in terms of what we can do, it's not one of these clear-cut things that has to do with U.S. legislation where you just sort of write and try to pass this bill. But the United States has direct influence and is probably the most important player, the government, that is, our government, in how this whole thing's going to be looked at. And so there is pressure to bear, and our congressional representatives can be part of that. What I would recommend is Bread for the World, the Interfaith Action for Economic Justice, and the World Council of Churches. These are all church-related organizations that are directly and very heavily involved in the debt crisis. They have excellent resources. I have a few things here. I didn't bring most of them with me. Really good resources, and Bread for the World has an action guide or a guide for activists that's very good and outlines a lot of the things that you can do and places where you can get more resources. There's also the Debt Crisis Network that has a quarterly report to talk about things, and the Institute for Food and Development Policy has done a lot. So what I would suggest to people who would really like to pursue this more, and I would certainly encourage you to do so, is write to these places and say that you're interested in the debt crisis and ask them what kind of resources they can give you, as well as what kind of action you can take in your own local areas, as well as what kind of action you can take with your own congressional representatives around the issue.